No. Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is July 20th, 2010, and this is episode 418. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always make the mainstream news, the sorts of things that are frequently labeled as alternative or paranormal. So, for those of you who would like to send in a question tonight and have it asked, you can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com or send it through the virtual auditorium on Pal Talk by text. I do monitor the email during the program, so if you're listening outside of the virtual auditorium and would like to have your question answered, please email it to me and I'll ask it for you. In the virtual auditorium, just put it into text and I'll try and catch it if the screen scrolls. And if I don't catch it the first time, repeat it again. And for those who are listening on a podcast, go ahead and email me too. I'll try and get your questions answered for you as well. For those of you who like to feel connected, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. There's even a fan page for the Dawn of Shades, so you can link to me there. For readers and foodies and camping fans, check out the articles and blogs. You'll find some material that interests you, too. Now, I do have a very important announcement before I go any further, because today is a very special day. It's my partner in life and work's birthday, so I want to wish Gregory Miller a very happy birthday. Even if it's not been a spectacular day, I have every confidence that the coming year will be a great one. So, happy birthday, Greg. 7 years ago, I moved to Louisiana from Arizona, and in those 7 years, I have learned a lot. I've changed a lot. Those changes don't happen without effort, without agony, without fear, without pain. I've made some great friends. I've been betrayed by a few that I believe to be my friends, and I've encountered people both good and bad along the route during the last 7 years. I've gotten to try the uncertainty of evacuation for Katrina, and the equally uncertain return to the aftermath of Katrina. I've watched Red Dog go from an exuberant young dog to an aging geriatric dog who struggles to maintain her youthful appearance and attitudes. I've seen my own hair go from dark to entirely silver, and wrinkles appear where once skin was smooth. The river of time isn't necessarily a kind one, even when the journey is amazingly interesting. Now, as I embark on the next segment of my journey, I'm wiser and I hope a kinder person. I'm no longer making a solitary journey accompanied by a big red dog, but I have the joy and comfort of making that journey with Gregory now. I'm learning new things about the give and take in a successful relationship and how it really works in practice, and about the joy of sharing that journey with someone. Rather than denying the spiritual aspects of who I am now able to embrace them, even while I'm torn by uncertainty and confusion. I'm able to see many things so much clearer, even while my physical eyes age and things get a little misty and blurred. I can see meaning behind words so much better, even as my hearing gets a little foggy with time. I can see the humor in the situation I find myself in, that just when I start to figure things out, my physical self is starting to fail. Now, over the past 8 months, I've been forced to slow down, to do things differently, or even just not do them at all, as I work to recover from an injury. I've learned that insurance companies have as much red tape as a government agency, and neither one is particularly concerned about my personal well-being. I've learned to slow down, to simplify things, to reevaluate what is really important, and not worry about the rest. I'm downsizing in every facet of my life. Why? Well, why is a great question. Why is because I need to, and it's good for all of us to do so. And you have to figure those reasons out for yourself. Now, tonight's guest has written a book, and like so many I've read in the past few months, I wish I'd read it a year or a decade or two ago. It's called Manual for Living Reality, A User's Guide to the Meaning of Life, and his name is Seth David Sharma. So, Seth, welcome to the program.
Gia, thanks so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is to introduce yourself to the audience. Tell them a little bit about yourself and where to find your book and your website.
You bet. I was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico. My father was born in Chihuahua, became a captain in the Navy, and my mother's from New York City. I spent 32 years in the public school system and then eventually followed her path and passion, became a medical intuitive and naturopath and kind of into vibrational medicine and so forth. So kind of have a diverse background. Basically went to public school there and had a childhood that was pretty traditional, other than the fact that I don't think I really wanted to be on this planet very much. It was kind of a hard transition for me. But eventually I went to college there, ended up taking some jobs at General Motors and overseas in Australia. I ended up back in Colorado eventually, started a few companies, and got diagnosed with cancer when I was 25 the first time. And that was pretty traumatic and life-changing in a very good way. Obviously, I didn't get everything I needed to the first time because I got diagnosed again 5 years later. And at that point, it was pretty clear to me that I also had to make some pretty significant life changes in my life. And I had written, it took me about 10 years to write this book. It's called Manual for Living Reality. There's actually three books. This is the first one. And if you want to learn about it, you can go to manualforliving.com. And if you want a free chapter, you could actually just send me an email. I'm at seth@manualforliving.com. I'd be happy to send you a free chapter and interact with you that way. But that's pretty much my story. And the book is brand new. It just came out a few weeks ago, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, they say that difficulties and obstacles and, you know, all that kind of thing builds character. I said, you know, look, I was born with enough character. Can't we do this a little easier? You know, and it, you find that to be true, that, you know, when you're faced with these obstacles, it does help your character to develop better coping mechanisms?
Yeah, I kind of think of it, you're absolutely right, it's kind of like driving down the street and you kind of ram into the curb and you mangle up your rims, but it keeps you on the road. And so I think we're given guidance as far as our path in life, and sometimes we like to ignore it, and we pay a price for that. The lessons get harder and more challenging. I know for me, I was given pretty clear direction with what I was supposed to do, but I wasn't totally paying attention. I didn't want to hear it. I felt like my path was the right path, even though I knew in my soul that there was a more pertinent one for me. And it took some pretty painful lessons to get me to change, just as you were sharing about. Sometimes it's the most painful things that finally get us to slow down, because we don't want to slow down on our own. That just doesn't seem natural. So it's almost like we have to crash into a wall before we wake up and go, wow, I really should take it easy here.
Yeah, you know, I think about it. I enjoyed the job that I was working. I actually got hurt at work. And it was one of those stupid things. I got hurt picking up a 15-pound dog. You know, I've bucked hay. Those three-wire bales weigh in at about 150 pounds. They weighed as much as I did. I never got hurt doing that. I never got hurt by horses or cows or big dogs. No, I get hurt by a 15-pound dog. And, you know, so, you know, you've got this silly injury that is, for me, it's been life-changing. You know, even something as simple as making bread, because I write about food, so obviously I do a lot of cooking. How do you knead bread? Most people do it with both hands, or at least their dominant hand. Well, it's my right arm that's messed up. I can't do it with my right hand. I cannot, and I've discovered that your right and left side are tied together. You can't do things with your left hand without it hurting your right arm. You know, so it did. It really made me stop, slow down, reevaluate how to do things, learn to work a little bit smarter to function around the house, because at first I couldn't even get myself dressed. And it really, you know, I'm like, good grief, I can't comb my hair. Gregory's a great guy, but he will never make a gay hairstylist. Yeah, I know that's a stereotype, but, you know, he really, he looked like I had combed my hair with an egg beater. Yeah, it was the best he could do, you know. I finally resorted to taking 6 inches off, you know, just to make things a little bit easier for me because I have long hair. And, yeah, it did. It really stopped me. It stopped me from doing a lot of things, hiking, camping. Somebody else has got to set up the tent. Somebody else has to lug this stuff. Somebody else has to load this stuff. And I'm used to doing all that stuff myself. So it really was, you know, a stop. And, you know, going from working 12-day weeks to not working at all was very, very difficult.
I imagine it was. You know, I think it's so funny that we, you know, we head in a certain direction in our life, and all of a sudden we're just in such a hurry to get there. And at some point we forget where we were going, but we're still in a hurry. And it's very rare that we actually stop and look at our life and say, gosh, is this really the direction I want to go in? And if we were just to take a break every now and then and reflect on our life and look at the choices we're making, we may actually make different choices. But we don't do that because we're creatures of habit. We quite often, as humans, we don't learn from our mistakes. And so we head in that direction, and eventually we end up having to go through something really traumatic like what you went through in order to be forced to reevaluate our life and see what good is to come from making changes in our life, whether voluntary or involuntary.
Yeah, in my case, I'm going to have to completely reevaluate what am I going to do for a living, because I can't do any of the things that I've done in the past. So it'll be something entirely new, you know, because as you go through, you know, your previous career paths that you've been on, you think, well, can I do that again? Well, no, I need two arms for that. You know, what can I do that doesn't require repetitive movement or, you know, being able to lift anything? And, you know, the list got real short, and you just keep going down it, and pretty soon there wasn't anything left. So I know that the next thing I do will be something new. And I have no idea yet what it's going to be.
And that can be scary, right? I mean, it can be totally scary.
Well,
it's like
terrifying because, you know, I've always been self-sufficient. And all of a sudden, I'm at the mercy of, you know, the insurance company and whatnot. And, you know, they determine what happens next because I'm no longer in a self-determining position.
Mm.
And that's kind of, you know, I'm a control freak. Okay, I'll fess up. I really am. I like to have everything under my control. And, you know, anytime you have to start yielding that control up, whether it's to your partner, whether it's to circumstances, whatever, that's traumatic. You know, I mean, it was traumatic when I even had to admit to myself, oh, wow, I am a control freak. I'm not, you know, I'm not the stereotypical severe case, but, yeah, I do like to be in control. I don't like things where I don't know what's going to happen next. And,
well, I think,
you know, I used to tell people, you can tell whether somebody's a control freak or not by, are they a dog person? Dog people are people who like control. Cat people are the opposite.
Yeah, that's funny. But it is interesting that that's what you're faced with. Like in your situation, we're all faced with whatever it is that confronts us the most. For you, you happen to be in a situation and an opportunity that you have to redefine that part of yourself, that whole controlling aspect, which, I mean, that's human nature. We want to be in control. Science is all about trying to understand and control the weather patterns, control our health, control how long we live. And there's limitations to all that. But in the end, there's only so much we can control. And it really is just who we choose to be in every moment, the actions we take, how we reflect across the world. But we try to take on the burdens of those around us. We try to control things that are outside of our control. And, you know, in the end, I think we end up being disappointed, frustrated, and exhausted. I grew up with an organic household. I exercised. I meditated. I really thought I had the perfect lifestyle. And when I was diagnosed with cancer, I just thought, this can't be happening. That can't be me. It must be a mistake. There's no way. I'd never taken a prescription pill, or maybe once or twice in my whole life. I'd never had a surgery. I'd never, you know, I just felt like I was, you know, the epitome of health. And so when I got cancer, I thought, this is the wrong person. There's no way that can be me. But I think we realized, and I realized, and I talk about it in the Manual for Living, that, you know, you can't avoid the inevitable. There are certain things that are inevitable in your life, not just death. There are certain opportunities, there are certain lessons that you either face them one way or you face them another way, but you're going to face them in some aspect of your life, and it just happened to be cancer for me, but it could be anything for anybody. It's just whatever is the color of your opportunity in life, I think.
Right, and, you know, one phrase in your book about us being spiritual beings with a physical experience right now, you know, that's been a popular theme. I'm beginning to say, okay, I'm getting the message, because it seems like over the past 6 months, everything that people have sent me has had that little phrase in it. And it's, if I flip open a book, that's the first one that's going to pop out. It's going to be right at the top of the page. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm getting the message here, you know, because we really are. And, you know, when I had to do that 360 and say, yeah, our spiritual side is important. Because I used to say, no, you can't measure it. You know, it isn't a part of our experience. It's not defining who we are, et cetera, et cetera. And now I'm saying, oh, yeah, you know, it is. It's very much a part of who we are. It's very important. And, you know, we've been denying that part of ourselves. In terms of popular culture, that has been on the back burner because everybody's been focused on science and technology.
Right.
And, you know, now I think it's time that maybe we do change that focus and focus more on our spiritual side, that non-physical side.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think there's only so much happiness that we can each obtain or create by focusing only on our physical world. And at some point, we're left unfulfilled and moderately happy. Maybe we're just subsisting through life. But at some point, we have to awaken and take some responsibility for the choices we made that brought us to this place in order to determine where we're going to go from here. That's going to bring us happiness. And usually, it involves some sort of service. I mean, I think that the happiest people in the world are those who have found ways to be of service to their community, their world, like your show. It's just there's something about sharing knowledge, sharing wisdom with people who are hungry for it, and I think that's part of life. If we can, you know, flip our lives around and put service first, put our priorities over the obtaining of money, then there's something about, you know, feeding our needs while being of service to others that really brings a lot of happiness and fulfillment, I believe.
You know, I think you do have a very valid point with that. You know, and the way I guess I'm looking at it is mainstream society focused on science and technology. In term, if you translate it to you know, eating habits, it's like all we're eating is junk food and fast food. And as long as we keep denying the non-physical aspects of ourselves, that's all we can have. You know, you can't get in to the grocery store and learn about anything else until you realize that the grocery store is non-physical.
Hmm.
You know, and without it, yet we are. You know, it's immediate gratification. It's surface stuff, and it lacks, you know, happiness. The kind of happiness when you don't involve your non-physical self is like junk food. You know, it only satisfies you a little while, and you want it again.
That's right.
And, you know, and without, you know, that's going to stay like that.
There's a certain hedonism I think we have as human beings that we don't want life to look a certain way, we want it to feel a certain way. And you're right, it's that instant gratification that we have a deep-seated desire, whether it's our life purpose or path or some big vision that we have for what we feel like is our destiny in life. Yet it's hard work, and it takes effort. And it's easier to say, well, I'll just watch another hour of television, or I'm just going to, you know, go to the bar, or I'm just going to do this, instead of focusing on what's most important. And before you know it, you know, that's been the pattern of your life for 5 years, 10 years, 30 years. And, you know, I think as human beings, we are limited in time. We don't know how much time we have left. But, you know, for me, when I wrote this book, it took me 5 years to publish the book, because I had to build up a lot of courage and a lot of strength, and it took situations in my life that pushed me to actually make that commitment. and to put my name on the book and actually stand behind the book and to send it out in the world. That was a really big deal for me. That was one of the things that took a lot of courage for me. For other people, it's, you know, being open and honest about their emotions, or it's physical issues, or whatever it is. We each have those things, but this was a very clear issue for me, and it basically paralyzed me, debilitated me for quite a long period of time. And again, it took me 5 years to actually, when I finished the book, to actually take it and send it out to the world. And I think, you know, we each need to look at what it is in our life that's holding us back, that's standing in the way, the things, the choices that we can make that really we know would make us happy, but we still put them off till tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, like, I know I need to become more regular with my meditation, but a lot of days it just doesn't happen. I get caught up in the trivia of a daily life. You know, this needs done, that needs done. I got to make this phone call. You know, I got to send this email, whatever. And before I know it, you know, the day's done, and I'm way too tired to try and meditate now. I'll just fall asleep trying to do it. And, you know, and then off I go, and the next thing I know, it's been a week. And without the meditation, do I feel as good? No. You know, maybe my, 'cause I've been really, really busy the past month, and that means that really often the meditation never happened. Is that why over the last month, you know, my shoulder's so much worse? Why, you know, it's so, I have more pain, more fatigue, and so forth and so on? Or, you know, what's going on with it? You know, why is it not getting better? You know, and so you do. You start to question yourself on that. You know, and at the same time, you know, am I making a better effort at making sure I meditate? Not really. You know, and I have to admit that I neglect it often. Because, again, it's the trivia of life that you get caught up in.
That's right. That's right. You sure do. And look, we all have far too many things for the time that we have available. I don't know anybody that has, you know, loads of free time and their task list is complete. I mean, nobody's like that. We have a million things to take care of, a million things to do, and there's just not enough time, just like there's never enough money for all the things that we want. But that doesn't mean that we can't prioritize. But meditation is a funny thing. I mean, you know, I tried for so many years to meditate. I did meditate. And then at some point I had this awakening that, you know, meditation for me wasn't the stereotypical meditation where you sit cross-legged on your mat and the peace and quiet, you've got your candles, your music, or whatever you set up for yourself. For me, I just had to find moments in my day that were more meditative in nature, like taking a walk or taking a hike, or, you know, even just finding pockets of time, a few minutes here to pick up a book and read a few words and contemplate that. But, you know, for me, the whole concept of closing my eyes and going inside, separate from my physical world, it's a conflict of interest for me. It doesn't actually work. Like, for me to really go inside, I need to be a part of my physical world. And that was just something that I realized for myself. But for each of us, I think that whole meditative nature is something that we have to discover, because not everybody can sit, you know, quietly, you know, with their eyes closed for, you know, 10, 20, even 30 minutes without, you know, being able to find some sense of peace.
Yeah, you know, I have to admit I don't meditate in a traditional manner, but, you know, I do usually sit quietly. I mean, about a half an hour usually is what I'll take. But, you know, like I said, over the past month I've been incredibly busy. I've been caught up in details of life and whatnot, and it just hasn't happened. And you know, as I have not been doing it, I've noticed a steady increase in stress level. And, you know, that's counterproductive. You know, it's just not something that is going to work for me, and I know that. So I'm going to have to just become a little bit more diligent, at least several times a week, in taking that time for me. And we do have a question from the Virtual Auditorium on the theme of your book. And can you summarize it in a few sentences?
I'd be happy to. The title for the book is Manual for Living, Reality, A User's Guide to the Meaning of Life. And that's probably the best summary I've got. It's a user's guide to the meaning of life. It's not your typical book. In fact, most of you who pick up this book will realize that there's probably no book or very few books like it. It's not designed to be read from cover to cover. In fact, it's the perfect book to read when you get up in the morning and you're sitting on the toilet and doing your business, or when you're sitting by the pool and you want a few minutes of insight, or when you're stopped at a stoplight and you can open the book. I mean, really, what I talk about is you take a breath and you open the book, and whatever chapter you open to maybe is the right chapter for you, and you read about it. But to talk about kind of how the book is organized, it's 16 major chapters. It covers everything from illness to money to death to our physical being to happiness to balance. I mean, and each one of those 16 chapters has about 4 or 5 sub-chapters to it. So there's about 80 individual chapters, and the book really is all about finding the meaning of life for you. So it's not a preachy book. In fact, each chapter is broken up into a couple of questions that have to do with your relationship to that topic, whether it's illness or death or money. But it really breaks down with how you understand the concepts that I've explained here, and maybe there's something there that will help you find more of a lasting happiness, or connecting with your inner truth, or finding your true purpose. There's insights here in every single chapter that I think would help a lot of people to overcome some of the challenges that they face. Like I said earlier, you know, we all have our challenges. There isn't one of us that is given a silver bullet where we get to bypass the issues in life. No, we all know people who are facing traumatic illness. We all know people who are dying. We all know people or ourselves who are out of work or short of money. I mean, that's just the nature of our world. But our opportunity is to figure out how we're going to react or relate to those situations in life. That is what we have control over. We don't have control over a lot of these outside circumstances that we get stressed out about, but we can control our attitude, and we can control the actions that we take. And so this book, in many ways, covers a lot of topics, real topics that face us in life, and different ways that we can approach them, perhaps with a softer heart and a better temperament.
I actually carried this book in my purse, and it went with me to doctor's appointments. And like I said, it was ideal because you didn't have to read it from cover to cover in one sitting. You could, you know, open it up and start where you left off, or start in a new section or wherever. And it is written in short segments that are real easy to understand as you're invest 5, 10, 15 minutes at a time. Of course, the doctor's office, we all know what that could be like. It might be 5 minutes. It might be an hour and a half. You never know. But yeah, it is a book that's, it's really easy to read because it's not meant to sit down and read it like a storybook or a how-to manual, because it's just not that way. It's written in short segments that are really easy to read in just a minute or two.
And I think there's a, and you're absolutely right, and I really appreciate you saying that. And I appreciate you taking it to the doctor's office. I don't know if it helped in any way, but at least you could hit the doctor with it. For me, the book is something that, you know, we have in many ways a short attention span for things that are very challenging or for issues in our life that are very difficult. There's only so much that we can absorb. And in many ways, we need to hear the same thing in a lot of different ways before we actually accept it. Kind of like what you're talking about earlier, is you keep seeing this understanding of our soul and our physical reality, and that just happens to be the message for you. Well, the message for me might be something totally different than the message for, you know, the audience that's listening here. And so we have to figure out and pay attention to what those messages are. This book, you know, I think it's simple that way, in that you don't have to commit a lot of time to it, but you can literally take one insight, one paragraph, one chapter, and take it with you the whole day or for a couple days, and just see how it affects your life. You just get to try it on. There's nothing here that says you have to change your life a certain way. It's just an opportunity to look at one part of your life, maybe in a different manner. Maybe it's the way you prioritize your life, and the way you set up time, and the way you categorize your calendar. There's little things in here that maybe you try them on for a little while, and maybe they work, and maybe they don't. And so you just keep the things that actually contribute to your overall well-being, and maybe at the end of the day, you found a way to make yourself happier and more fulfilled in life.
It's funny. I just flipped open the book, which I have in my little hands as we speak, and guess what section it opened up to? Chapter titled Slow Down.
And that is, boy, that is your lesson right now, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, he starts off the chapter, he's got a quote from somebody, and then he'll have a few questions. Like, in Slow Down, it's, why are we in such a hurry? Where are we going? The time is of the essence. What is so important that it forces us to disregard the glory of the present moment and focus on a moment that is yet to come? You know, it's not that you give the answers to those questions, because you don't. You're teaching us how to ask questions. of ourselves. You know, we've got our answers. We all have our own answers. But we've just forgotten to listen to ourselves. And you sort of open the dialogue with ourselves.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. You really nailed it. In fact, I will venture to say that in my new book, Manual for Living, there's nothing in there that you haven't already heard somewhere. But it might be in a different way that allows you to maybe absorb it. Maybe you hear it in a different perspective, or maybe you hear it for the fifth time and it allows you to finally understand it and see how it applies to your life. But you're right, this isn't a book of answers so much as it's a book of understanding. I mean, people ask me, well, gosh, what is the meaning of life for me? And the only thing I can say is that we each have to discover it for ourselves, just like you said in your opening monologue. We each have to discover it. But if there's something out there that can help us better understand ourselves, help us better see what the meaning of life is for each of us, then that's an opportunity, that there's a choice that we can make that brings us closer to what we feel that our source is or our life purpose is. And that is really the goal of the book. It doesn't give you the answer, but it does help you find it.
Well, you know, too often a lot of us have the habits of a 10-year-old in a hurry. We don't want to know how to solve the problem. We just want the quick fix answer. You know, is it 42 here? Yeah. What is the meaning of life? I want the answer. And, you know, we do. A lot of people, myself included, we're looking for the fast fix. The Band-Aids, everything that's wrong with us, the magic bullet, the magic pill, however you want to put it, the magic potion. And everything will be all better. And, you know, it's sad but true, there is no such thing. And snake oil that people promise you isn't going to do anything. But, you know, a manual for living reality, yeah, that's a case of, you know, it tells you what questions to ask yourself to look for your problem. Yeah, so we have a question from the virtual auditorium. So there's no central insight, like answers, that run through the different sections. I would say no. How about you, Seth?
Well, boy, it is really hard to explain, and I guess I better get a better explanation for this. There are actually statements of truth that guide you to your answer. And we could pick a couple and read from the book, but that'd be kind of boring. But, you know, you can pick a section of it and look at the question itself. You know, there's a question, for example, living in balance that says, you know, what does it mean to live in balance? But then through the chapter, there's little insights and pearls of wisdom that are truths, but you have to apply them to your own life because there's no guidebook that's going to work for every single person in the world. There's only a guidebook that can give you insights to make the better decisions for yourself. And I think that's the distinction. And it's like you said, there's no silver bullet that's going to give us all the answers, is going to solve the problem, nor should there be. The whole purpose of life is to go through this journey and to learn what we're here to learn and discover and to be of service and to find happiness and to share love. And I mean, that is part of life. If you could go through life and learn the lesson of love without experiencing it, what would the fun of that be? But the same goes for illness and pain, that there's a lesson and there's something to gain from those opportunities. And we individually have the opportunity to look at each of those things and say, what's in it for me? What can I learn from this? What can I gain from this? I went through cancer. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me. Of course, it happened twice. I should have figured it out the first time. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't traumatic. I'm not saying facing death wasn't one of the most difficult things I ever did. But in hindsight, always in hindsight, you can look back and you can say, wow, I learned this. I learned how to better relate to my life. I made better choices. And I have a belief that in our life, as we face obstacles, we really have that choice. We can suffer. We can be in pain. We can get laid off from work, and we can say, gosh, that's awful. I hate my last company that I worked for. They treated me like garbage. I don't like my government benefits. My life stinks. And we can be in misery and pain, and we can suffer, and we can create actually illness for ourselves from all of the frustration we have inside. Or we can say, wow, this could be an opportunity for me. And I'm not minimizing what it's like to live without enough money. I do that. I know what that's like. I've done that for a lot of years. I'm not saying that that makes it easy, but there's an opportunity there to look at your life and say, what's the gift here? Do I get to change occupations? Maybe I can actually go and move forward with what I've always wanted to do, be a social worker, be a teacher, be a doctor, whatever it is. Maybe now is that opportunity for me, because I was afraid to make that choice before. But now, the hardest decision was made for me. I'm out of my job. I've got time. I've got some freedom here. I actually can make the choice that's going to bring me happiness and allow me to have a fulfilled life. Those aren't small decisions by any means. But I think, you know, through this book and through other books, there's information there that can help us to make better choices in our life.
You know, it's very, very true. I think about it in my own case. You know, I wasn't making any changes because I had a job, and it's a tough economy. Why give up a perfectly good job just because, you know, it's kind of gotten boring and you're really tired of 12-day weeks? Why change where you're living even though it's really inconvenient for everything but work? When the job no longer existed because of the injury, there was no longer those reasons. It took losing those things before I could see a path to freedom. You know, now, okay, granted, I can't use my arm very well, but I have an immense number of choices. I'm no longer locked into a particular job. Okay, granted, I don't have one at all, but I have the freedom to choose now. I'm not, you know, locked into anything. It's just meant giving up that little control thing again, you know?
And that's a hard thing. Control is a really, really hard thing, and I definitely commend you on facing that and acknowledging it. That's really tough. And I know there's a lot of people in this world right now that are hurting and trying to figure out what's next in their life, and we each have that opportunity. You know, we spent so many decades driven by money and by what money can buy and having a bigger house and the boat and the fast car and the vacations, and, you know, very few of us have actually stopped to say, boy, is any of that stuff actually making me happy? There's so many people that have so much money and are so miserable. And I lived in Guatemala for 6 months with a beautiful family down there. It was just a really small little hut. I lived in a little 4x6 room. I think the roof was some kind of tin thing. The mother of the family lived next door. The kids lived behind them. You know, every day they would go to the market and pick up a couple things. They'd make one meal and eat the leftovers the next day, and the next night it was the same meal and then eat the leftovers. I mean, it was just the simplicity of their life was mind-blowing, but the amount of happiness they had is almost unimaginable compared to most of the people in our society where we have almost everything that we could ever want. And that, I think, is the distinction in our society where there's an awakening that I think is happening, and it continues to happen where people are starting to make better choices. This isn't new for me. This isn't new information. But I think if there's things that I can do, if my book can help people, I mean, gosh, it's only like $11 on Amazon right now on sale. I mean, that's not a big commitment. You spend $11, and if there's a chance that you could find a greater level of happiness, if you can relate better to the pain and the issues that you face in your life, is that worth $11? I think it is. But it's not just this $11, it's also making the choices in your life that will follow through on your commitment to happiness. That's really our opportunity, right? I mean, that's the whole point of us getting up in the morning and being of service to our children and our in-laws and our family and friends and coworkers and clients. That's our job in life. We serve. And through that service, sometimes we're rewarded with money and sometimes we're rewarded just with gratitude.
Yeah, you know, last night I was talking with a gentleman who had suffered a major downturn, you know, with the economy's crash and everything a couple years ago. And it's been a continual struggle until he was basically, you know, he had one of his houses in foreclosure and he was having to sell everything he owned and whatnot. And he said it's the best thing that ever happened to him. If you kind of think about that, financial disaster is the best thing that ever happened to him. He said that his head had gotten too big for him, and as he put it, his poo, well, I'm G-rating it for the radio, but his poo didn't stink. You know, he really thought he was, you know, the cat's pajamas. And he'd become a complete and utter snob, somebody he didn't even like. And by losing everything, it made him think about who he was and what was really important. And, you know, as he's downsizing his life, you know, his plans are much, much smaller now, but they're plans to make him happy rather than this he who dies with the most toys wins sort of mentality. And it was really interesting to talk to somebody who flat out said that losing everything was the best thing that had ever happened to him.
Amazing. It's really amazing.
And, you know, on the economic note, too, if you look at statistics, during economic hard times, you're going to see more small businesses open up. You're going to see more true examples of entrepreneurs creating a position for themselves. And necessity, you know, sort of pushed them into it, perhaps. Or maybe it was losing that job provided them with the opportunity to get creative at making a living. So, you know, I've often told people, you know, maybe you just need to change your perspective. Hang that Christmas tree upside down in your living room. It'll look a whole lot different than it does in the traditional way. And maybe we need to do that more often with our personal issues, too.
I think you just hit on something so very big. I mean, you could have taken two people that had the exact same situation. They both lost everything. Your friend or associate comes out the other side feeling empowered and strong and finally making choices that are in alignment with who they know themselves to be, even though they're subsisting on a much smaller scale. And you have the other person who walks out angry, frustrated, upset, pissed off. His life is going to be in ruin until one day he accepts that there's something greater there for him. But they both had the same opportunity. But one made one choice and one made another. But that is our own opportunity in life. You know, we are going to be faced with things that, as I say, you can't control. We're going to be faced with illness that you will have no control over. And you'll have one person who is angry and fearful and upset, and someone else who walks out the other side after going through their emotions saying, you know what, I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to enjoy every minute that I'm alive, and I'm going to do good things with my life for however much time I have left. It's really who we choose to be that determines how much pain and suffering we have as a result of what we're presented with. I think it's really inspiring, that story. I think it's amazing that people can actually be faced with so much hardship and walk out holding their head up high and say, you know what, this is the best thing that happened, and I can change my life because of it.
You know, and often it's many, many things that happen in our lives that we have no control over. My son died when he was 10 years old. Obviously, I had no control over that. You know, you really can't even control your response as a parent. That's devastating. So, as you come through it, the grieving process is very, very painful. On the bad days, for me, what would get me through it was the thought of meeting my son in the afterlife and having to explain to him that I was not the person that he thought I was. Which, of course, he thought I was perfect. So, you know, granted, this perfect parent that he perceived didn't exist. You know, I didn't have the answer to everything. I really couldn't do everything. But in his eyes, I could. And there's no reason why I couldn't do many, many more things. But to just give up and quit was an unacceptable answer. So that was the perception that I chose to get through the really rough time.
You know, I would
so we
probably
are.
Venture.
We're faced with very difficult things in life that we don't have control over. And, you know, we can choose how we respond to the event. Do I consider it the best event in my life? Oh, obviously not. But it came out on the other side.
I think it's really inspirational that you did. That's one of the hardest things I think anybody in their entire life would have to go through is losing a child. I think that's amazing that you've come through and you're still here.
Well, you know, I'm not the first person, and I'm not the last. And, you know, was my grieving any less or any more? No. You know, I cannot imagine a parent, you know, you read all the time about parents who have done terrible things to their children, even killed them. I have absolutely no way of comprehending what would make a person do that. That's just so far out of my ability to understand, I don't even try. But, you know, any parent that's lost a child has grieved intensely. But I have seen, at the same time, I had an aunt, one of my cousins was killed in an accident same week I graduated from high school. And her response to that event was dramatically different than mine. Now, granted, I was very young when it happened. But she actually became a bitter and unpleasant person. And I remember telling my aunt, you know, even at the funeral, if I become like so-and-so, just shoot me. You know, don't let me do that. Don't let me become that bitter, angry person who's angry at the world and everybody in it that has what she lost. Because that's not right. So maybe having a very negative example in my youth helped form the response that I was going to take later in life.
Well, it sure wasn't a coincidence.
Yeah, because really, that was my example. Oh, please don't let me end up like that. You know, it's a very hard thing. It doesn't matter if they're 10, 18, or 30. I don't think your parental response is going to be any different at all. You know, I worry the same. My daughter's 27. I worry the same over her now as I did when she was 7. She got a little more freedom. You know, I don't worry about her crossing the street anymore. I figure she can manage that. But, you know, if I could wrap her up in cotton wool and put her in Tupperware and keep her safe, I'd do that, too. However, I think she'd complain.
A big Tupperware container?
Yeah. Well, she's not a very big person. She's short, but still be a big one, you know. Yeah, and I think she would really complain about that process of being stuck in the Tupperware anyhow. She's very independent and bossy, and that's the way it should be. As a parent, I regarded it as my job to get her ready, spread her wings, and fly. Even if I didn't want her to fly very far.
Right.
Yeah.
I understand. I've got two boys, and they each have their own challenges and beauty, and you just have to deal with them one day at a time, and you have to find your gratitude, and, you see the parts of them that are amazing, and you try to help the parts that aren't so great, and you try to help them figure things out so maybe they don't have to make the same mistakes you did. Maybe they don't have to trip and fall and bruise themselves as much, but they end up doing it anyway, and that's part of their growth. And you just have to stand by and clean them up and stand them up, and they fall again. And that's just seems like that's a never-ending job of a parent and a friend and a spouse and a son or daughter. I mean, that's our job. We're there for the people we care about the most.
Exactly, and I think those are the sorts of things that actually do make us the happiest. You know, is when we are able to help somebody dust off and then take off again, and the next time they fly straight and true, exactly where they want to go. As a parent, though, I have to say that when my daughter was born, because my daughter was the oldest, I said, I want my daughter, because I always regarded myself as somewhat of a pushover. I didn't stand up for myself the way I felt that I probably should. And I was like, I want to make sure that she can stand up for herself, that she's able to think for herself and make her own decisions and stand up for those. And, you know, I didn't qualify that, you know, because I should have said that she'd listen to me. Because this was a child that she was making her wants and desires known by the time she was 2 weeks old, and she has been hard-headed from birth. You know, she really is. There's not a doubt in my mind she can stand up for what she wants, because she can. Very much so. I saw her at 2 years old chew out a waitress and a restaurant manager to the point that they gave us our dinner for the entire party free, and a coupon to come back again.
Go, girl.
And I thought, wow, that kid's got a mouth on her already. She should have become a lawyer or something like that, because yeah, she really is. But you know, who knows what she'll choose, you know, by the time her ride is through. But it's up to her. Yeah, she definitely is quite verbally convincing about anything that she feels strongly about, which is most things. She's quite passionate about most things. Very little is met with any sort of lukewarm response from her. So it is. It's interesting to watch children grow up and assert their personalities and move through life. You know, I wonder if I entertained my parents as much as she's entertained me.
I would say without a doubt, I bet you did.
Yeah, I have to wonder. At the same time, you know, the relationship between myself and my parents and my daughter and I, much, much different. And, you know, that was partly a conscious choice on my part because I felt the relationship I had with my parents was a little old-fashioned. It was not very open with communication and whatnot. I have a much more open relationship with my daughter, which there's pros and cons to that, too, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, communication and relationship is such a huge, huge part of life. Actually, you know, I mentioned earlier in the book Manual for Living, there's actually three books. The second book, it's dedicated, and it's not out yet. I'm just saying it because we're talking about it. But the second book is all about communication and connection because I think that is one of the preeminent parts of a life fulfilled is finding ways to fully open your heart, to fully engage in relationships, whether it's with the closest people to you, your children, your spouse, your parents, or even to your associates, coworkers, neighbors. Like, there's a relationship dynamic that I think needs to be deepened in our lives, and that provides so much of the support structure that we desire and require to exist in this world. This is not an easy life. It really isn't. People go through thinking that everything is, you know, peachy and it should be perfect and should flow. My teenage son sure feels that way, that everything should just be handed to him in a certain way, and that's just not the way life is. And I think that there's something to this world that we just somehow our children or certain people think that it's just supposed to be easy, and it's not. There's just it's a challenging life. It's challenging to get through this world and make it out, make it through the other side with a smile on your face. It is.
Yeah, you know, and there again, I think it kind of boils down to perception. And I think back to my own youth, there were two old ladies in this little town that I lived in. And both of them, I worked in a restaurant, and both of them came in the restaurant every day to eat their evening meal. One was a bitter, unpleasant woman who was known for shooting neighborhood kids with BB gun and cursing people out, and nobody wanted to be around her. So she spent all her time complaining how our children and grandchildren and neighbors and so forth all were terrible people who just wouldn't pay her any attention. Now, the other one was a very pleasant woman who happened to share my first name. So, you know, I obviously, you know, felt a sort of kinship. And she was called by a nickname of Woody instead. But she was a very happy woman. Everybody loved her. And everybody would go out of their way to help her. Whereas the other one, you know, I'm not sure that they'd have done anything for her, even if her house was on fire. Because she was really that unpleasant. I mean, she was always negative and nasty and bitter, and it was no wonder her children and grandchildren didn't want to be around her. And, you know, why? I mean, like I said, you know, she even shot neighborhood kids with a BB gun. You know, she's lucky she never put out an eye or caused a serious injury, because it just really wasn't right. And she was really, really nasty. So neighborhood kids would do things to her. You know, they'd put bags of dog poo on her doorstep and, you know, light it on fire, ring the doorbell, and run away. They thought that was very amusing. And, you know, they would put disgusting things in her mailbox. And, you know, it was always pranks because she was like a big target because she was so nasty and unpleasant. You know, even if parents caught them, they couldn't really blame the kids much because this lady almost asked for people to be mean to her.
Right.
You know, and, you know, the other one, like I said, it was completely the opposite. And you're like, I know which one I want to be when I get old.
Did you ever read the book to your kids, The Worst Person on Crab Beach or something? Do you remember that book?
No, I don't remember that one.
It's about this guy who, I mean, he was growing poison ivy in front of his house, and he was just miserable all the time, and he was hoping for rainy days, and he goes on vacation, and he meets people that are just as bad as he is, and they end up, you know, becoming really good friends, and there's a scene at the end where they're celebrating with prune juice and dry wafers, and, you know, it just, there's something about that science, about that book that just, it speaks to exactly what you're saying. It's like, some people found a way to operate through their misery, and it's absolutely amazing that they continue to hold on to it, and they have the self-fulfilling prophecy of people treating them that way and supporting their need to be angry and miserable.
Yeah. You know, they must get something out of it. You know, whether you want to say they were evil in a former life or whatever, I don't know. But I don't know what they get out of it, because, you know, everybody, when they would see this lady coming, they would try to go the other way, duck behind a wall, you know, somehow disappear and pity the poor clerk that had to wait on her. You know, because it was going, they were going to get cursed out at least once, probably at the top of her lungs. You know, I saw her do it everywhere, from doctor's office, restaurant, every store in town. She really did curse out everybody at the top of her lungs. Nobody wanted to wait on her. You know, everybody would try to disappear, you know, and I'm like, you know, it'd be so much easier for you if you just be nice. And I guess she'd been that way for 30 years.
It's amazing how much we can get with kindness, and how much that makes a difference in our life. You know, just finding that place to breathe and to smile and to laugh and to be appreciative. And, you know, I think it's actually a big tenet of the Manual for Living. It's all about how we relate to that world and how we find parts of ourselves that we can share that actually positively contribute. And it's not easy. There's always situations where we find ourselves, you know, we get mad at, you know, the flight attendant or the reservation agent or the bartender because he screws up our drink or whatever. There's more than enough people for us to get angry at. But the real opportunity for us is, even in the midst of situations that don't go the way we want, where we cannot control them, to find ways to express gratitude and to be kind and to be nice. And I think that it's not so much for the other person, although that does make a difference, but it's a reflection on how we feel inside and who we choose to be. There is something about that, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, when you look on it, I can't help but remember, and I don't remember who told me this, but years ago, excuse me, someone told me, you know, when you see that sour person at the store or wherever, smile at them, because that might be the only thing anybody gives them all day long. You know, that's true.
You never know, right? You never know.
You
never know what happened to them.
To smile at somebody at a grocery store, or the laundromat, or the post office, or wherever you happen to be. And often that smile can completely change things for somebody. I mean, think about when you're having a bad day, and someone is nice to you, be it a store clerk or another customer or whatever, it sort of takes the rough edge off.
You're absolutely right. It does. And I think there's a perspective there. That, you know, as bad as our life is, there's always somebody who has it worse. You know, as bad as the worst things that have ever happened to us, I promise you there's somebody that's had it worse. It's had worse things happen, where it's, whether it's physical pain or loss of people we love or illness or money, there's always people that have been through worse. And we can suffer and allow ourselves to be full of self-pity, but if we can find some level of gratitude and realize that no matter what, the situation could be worse, X or Y could have happened, or anything worse than where we are absolutely could have happened, there is a space for gratitude. And I think when we get in places where we're stuck, we're miserable, we're frustrated, if we could take a minute to take a breath and reflect on our life, we can find that gratitude and we come back to that place of kindness. And it's a diligence. It takes effort. It does not happen many times naturally. It takes a little bit of work. But I think we can reflect on it sometimes by, you know, looking at our own life. You know, for me, you know, I went through cancer twice. Okay, a lot of people have been through so much worse than me. There's a lot of people that didn't survive cancer. I know quite a few. So I look at it for myself, and it gives me a little bit of boost to my step. It allows me to be just a little bit more grateful than I might have been normally. But I think we could all do that, and we could all be so much happier if we just reflected for a minute on so many great things that we, you know, we have to be thankful for.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me, my daughter is a diabetic. She was, you know, diagnosed when she was 15, and she was in and out of the hospitals all the time, especially that first 5 or 6 years. And she'd be whining about poor, poor me, and especially when she was young enough that she was, like, in the children's hospital and whatnot, and I'd say, you know what, look around you. You don't have anything to gripe about. You have something you can live with. You have something that lets you go swimming, lets you go hang out with your friends, lets you do almost everything everybody else does. These kids don't. So I'm, you know, I wasn't, I guess, a very sympathetic parent, but I was like, yeah, okay, diabetes is bad. You know, yeah, it limits some of the things you want to do. But you know what? It's not that bad. You can live with this. Granted, it isn't what you wanted. It isn't what I wanted, but we can't undo it. So this is a livable situation.
That's right.
And
even though you could say that to her, but at some point she'd had to experience it. And I think that is part of life, isn't it? Like, no matter what you say, whether to your children or the people that you love, you can tell them what you see as the truth, the opportunity for them, whether they're in a bad relationship or a bad job. But it doesn't really matter, because at some point they have to see it within themselves. And that's probably the challenge you had with your daughter, is that you could say it till you're blue in the face, but at point she had to experience that and realize, wow.
I think it was the first time she had a friend die. You know, and one of her friends, first he was also had diabetes. First he lost his vision, and then he died a few years later. And he was very young. Especially in her particular case, because he was well known for not following the rules. And, you know, diabetes is tough, especially type 1 diabetes, and you do have to follow the rules. There's no, you know, path to get you past, you know, X, Y, or Z. You know, you can't go past go and collect, you know, a new body or anything. Once you do the damage, it's there forever. And, you know, now she has some regrets for those years when she thought she was immortal. But, you know, if all of us think back to when we were, say, 15 to 20, 25, most of us thought we were immortal. Okay, we did really stupid things. You know, that's you know, just that's part of youth. We don't realize how mortal we really are. But, you know, in some people's case, they have to be a little bit more conscious of their choices than others. Is it fair? No. But like I told her, life is not fair. It's not fair to me. It's not fair to you. It's not fair to anybody. That's just the way it is.
That's right.
You know, it's like a random toss of the dice. And, you know, I have this funny vision for when life is really crappy and throwing me one bad thing after another. I have these 12 ladies of fate, I call them, and they're all older ladies, and they're dressed in the most outlandish outfits you could possibly imagine, you know, striped socks, purple and green, and, you know, purple dresses and red hats and orange lace. I mean, just, you know, put them in the most outlandish possible outfits with the loudest, most clownish-looking makeup, and they're up there cackling like a bunch of hens, and peering down at the world where I'm at, and they throw these things at me, and then just laugh as I figure out how to deal with them. You know, that's my little personal imagery to get over the speed bumps of life, like when your car breaks down, and an unexpected bill comes in, and the bank screws up your account, and your computer breaks, and the air conditioner goes out, and it's all in the same week, you know? And we've all had weeks like that. That's the ladies of fate up there cackling away, you know. And by, you know, making these cartoonish characters, that's my way of just adding a little levity to something I can't really change.
That's really nice. That's a good way of approaching it. I mean, it'd be nice if we each had something like that that we could relate our lives to that would give us a little lighter reflection on the tough situations that we face. But you're right.
I have a twisted way of observing the world sometimes. But yeah, those ladies of fate have been with me a long time, long since before the Red Hat Society ladies. But they really put the Red Hat ladies to shame, because they're out much louder, much louder. Yeah, you know, and that was just these visual sorts of things that I create are my personal coping mechanism. And, you know, are they healthy? Well, I think so, but, you know, maybe somebody will tell me no, it's a sign of psychosis or something. But yeah, I do. I have these imaginary characters, you know, that I can blame things on when I want to. And yeah. Why not?
You know, we have to do what works for each of us. It's going to be different. There's no right or wrong. We have the opportunity to make choices, and the truth is that it doesn't really matter what choice we make. It's our choice. And, you know, some people can judge it. We can judge our decisions, but every choice we make, right or wrong, good or bad, it takes us one step closer to where we're going. So I think we have a tendency to beat ourselves up and get upset with ourselves, or we allow other people to judge us. But you've come up with something that works for you, that supports you in making better choices for yourself, and it supports you in not maybe feeling like you have to be in control, or supports you in being at peace. I think we each have certain coping mechanisms, and as long as they're supportive, and as long as they help us, I don't think there's anybody that could say that's bad for us. I mean, you look at, you know, what's been coming out with climate change, and yeah, you could get upset with a scientist for coming out with maybe not sharing all the information, but if at the end of the day, there's things that are done in our society to give us cleaner air or cleaner water, you can't complain about that. At the end of the day, that benefits everybody. And so I think we have to be focused on the end result of a lot of these choices that we make, because in the moment, they may be kind of painful or they may be kind of demented, but if they get us where we need to go and they don't harm anybody, then I can't see that there's anything wrong with them.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I never regarded as myself as being anything wrong with them. To me, they were harmless little imaginary characters that, like I said, the speed bumps of life, you know, do they have little voices that tell me to, you know, do bad things to other people? No. You know, I'm not crazy. I don't have voices that talk to me and tell me to do things like that. My Rice Krispies have never said a word to me, you know. But I can have imaginary characters that I can blame for the van breaking down or the air conditioner going on the fritz or whatever. You know, life, you know, tosses in terms of these little minor obstacles. And I don't see anything wrong with it. You know, as for me, there are harmless caricatures that symbolize things that I can't control.
I think that's great.
And, you know, I think about, you know, all the coping mechanisms that we need to get through the day-to-day life. And because sometimes life does dump on us. You know, and people can go on about, you must have done something to deserve that hogwash, you know. Sometimes life just dumps on you, all right? You know, I don't think it has anything to do with you get what you deserve. No. Sometimes you just do. You get dumped on. You know, it's like a random act of misery, you know, comes your way. But at the same time, random acts of absolute wonderfulness come your way. You know, we've all had the really wonderful experience. It was totally unplanned and just sort of fell in our lap.
That's right. I think there's go ahead, Gia.
A beautiful sunset, having to take a detour because of road construction and seeing something that you never dreamed existed. It can be something simple.
Right. No, you're so right on. I think that there are coping skills, but there's things that can help us when life is challenging. When life is easy, we just don't need a lot of help, right? I mean, we're not praying, we're not wishing for help, we're not crying. When life's great, life's great. It's when life isn't great that we need support and we need help. And, you know, thinking back to that question that you got, you know, what does this book really give you? What's the purpose of the Manual for Living? I think it's really to cope with the times when we are most challenged, when we do have difficulty in our lives. But there are little things. I think there's little things, little choices, little situations that we can enhance or evolve or make in our life that make a big difference, like getting enough sleep at night. I mean, you have a life where, like you said, everything starts crashing down, everything happens at the same time. Well, there's no better time to have a good night's sleep. There's no better time to have a good diet or to get some exercise or, as you say, to meditate. That's the time when you need it, right? You don't need it when you get that beautiful sunrise when you're having a margarita sitting on the beach in Costa Rica. You don't need to meditate. But you do when everything's falling down around you and your roof collapsed. So I think that's really our opportunity, is that we forget. You know, we forget to breathe. You know, breathing is, you know, one of the most healing elements to our life. One of the best coping mechanisms we have is just to breathe. And yet the first thing that happens when we're in a stressful situation is we stop breathing. And all of a sudden, we stop functioning and our body starts breaking down in so many ways. So I think when we do face difficult situations, I think if we kind of compartmentalize our life and look at little areas that we can make a little contribution that might make us feel just a little bit better, it just gives us the strength and sometimes it gives us the wisdom to make better choices in those moments.
Yeah, you know, those questions in there, I think, really are geared specifically to help us make some better choices when times are tough, when the choices are tough. It's often, and we're faced with these choices, and they're all difficult choices, between a rock and a hard place, per se, you know. And we don't make a choice. Well, in essence, that becomes our choice. Then we're forced into another situation that we took no action to direct at all. And, you know, I just about guarantee it's not going to be better.
You're right. Well, no choice is a choice, right? I mean, that is
right.
That is choosing something by not choosing it. It's kind of like in life, I have this theory that there's a, and I write about in the book, there's a cancer of the soul. And it's more devastating than cancer of the body. Because the cancer of the soul is debilitating. And in life, we do have responsibility to make choices. And we are, in this moment, the sum total of every choice we've made throughout our entire life. In this moment, who we are in this moment, the reality of our world, is a result of the choices that we've made. Okay, so here we are in this moment, and we can choose to take steps, to take actions that are supportive of our growth or not. We can take choices that will support supportive of living or not, but we can't stay still. There's no stagnant nature to life. And so if we're not living or growing in life, then we are slowly dying in life. We're slowly deteriorating. And I affectionately call that the cancer of the soul, because we're actually allowing some part of our soul to deteriorate because we're not accessing it. It's not that our soul dies. It's just that we distance ourselves from it and we make choices that aren't consistent with our life path, and we slowly die because of it. Maybe we die because we have a lack of interest in life, or we die because we lose some of our emotional connection to our happiness or to love. But we have, there's something wrong there. It's like a disease of our being that we're making the absolute wrong choices when we really could be making the right ones. And we really get to choose it. Like you said, it's like it's really up to us. But so often than not, we end up just not choosing anything, thinking that that's not a choice. We wait, but that is a choice. It takes us in the wrong direction, I think.
Yep, and now it's time for us to make a choice and take our break. So folks, while we're away from your computer, check out our website, www.theisogynynetwork.com, and stay tuned, and the Dawn of Shades will return with our guest, Seth David Chernoff.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Do you like to have questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We'll go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
The sky, wondering if there's something out there. In fear of things going bump in the night.
Whispers Radio brings you headfirst into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Thank you. Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? Then, join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
A radio program that looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, with our guest, Seth David Chernoff. And once again, I would like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, and let me know what you think of it. You have links there to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you want to go straight to the blog, it's giascott.wordpress.com, and you'll find out what kinds of things I'm up to lately. Now, if you have a question that you wish to have asked, you can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. I am monitoring the email during the program with Seth tonight, and I'm trying very hard not to miss anything. And don't forget, for those of you listening on the podcast, you can also send me your questions by email, and I will try and get them answered for you as well. So, Seth, where were we besides at choices?
That's pretty much where we were, about, you know, how we face life and we respond to obstacles and who we choose to be, and that irritable old lady living down the street. It's been good so far. It's been great.
Yeah, that little old lady down the street. You know, and they come in many, many flavors. I announced to my family and friends when I was, probably in my early 20s, I never wanted to live in a retirement community because everybody there was mean, nasty, and bitter, and wondered why their family and grandchildren wanted nothing to do with them. And there again, it's because they've segregated their community, I think. You know, they've removed themselves from the community at large. In general, people are designed to interact with each other, not a specific age group, not a specific race or, you know, belief system or religion or whatever. But we're designed to interact with each other. And if we don't do that, if we don't choose to do that, we're going to miss some important things that we need to do.
You're absolutely right. It's how we pay attention, I think. And I think there's so much that we miss. We don't listen to our truth a lot of the time. We're given access to so much. We have information that's being presented to us in so many methods and manners, yet we so often disregard it for the activities of the moment. We disregard our truth for what we did yesterday. We don't trust ourselves to make the right decisions. And we're always asking our neighbor for advice about our medical conditions, or, you know, our best friend for advice about our job. And, you know, we don't trust what we know is the right answer for ourselves. I think that if we could really look at ourselves and look at the choices that we make, maybe even just have a little faith in our own ability to make the right choices for our life.
Yeah, and you know, it's very, very true. We can get very good advice from people who really know. We're not going to pay any attention to it. That's a fact of life. Not a one of us could say, oh, I always pay attention to good advice. Bull hockey. We don't. We have to learn the hard way. Okay, I'll take one example, all right? My brother told me when we were teenagers to not ever get in trouble because I wouldn't like jail. I did believe him. But, you know, that inner voice said, you know what, he's probably right. was that taking advice? Well, in a sense, but, you know, at the same time, it was backed up by plain old common sense. I was not going to like that very much. Most of the time, no, we don't take advice. I think back to some very important points in my life when I was given advice that would have saved me a great deal of pain and heartache. And did I listen? No.
It's funny how we don't listen. I mean, it's funny how we talked about this earlier on your show. We make the same mistakes over and over again. You know, we date someone, and we have a miserable relationship. It takes us years to get out of it, and then we get right back into a new relationship with a new person with exactly the same dynamic. You know, we do that in our jobs, we do that in our life. Like, we just take so much for us to get the lesson and move on with it. You know, for me, it's almost like I had cancer twice because the first time I didn't quite figure it out enough. So I had to go through it all one other time so that maybe I could face exactly what I ignored the first time. For me, it was a little more complicated than that, but there was some of that where I just didn't slow down enough. I didn't stop. I didn't change course enough in my life, and I paid a price for that. I could have done it an easy way, and instead I had to take it the hard way.
Yeah, and we do have a question coming up in the virtual auditorium, and that is, how hard is it for some people to simply smile?
Wow. How hard is it for some people to simply smile? I guess it depends on the people. I think we all know people in our lives who, for whatever reason, it would take plastic surgery to get them to crack and show a tooth. But I think for most of us, sometimes you fake it till you make it, and other times it just takes that deep inner knowing that you've got some gratitude, you have some appreciation, you have some joy to share. Like I was saying before, I think I personally believe that a lot of this life can be very, very challenging. We all have to face death. We all have to lose at some point in time the people that we care about. We all have to be faced with illness or faced with a lack of money. That's just part of this life. And I think if we can find a better perspective, if we can find an understanding of how we relate to our world, we could still smile even in the worst of situations. And it's kind of like you said, you can smile to that woman in the grocery store that had a terrible day, and you make your whole day. You make her day. And in many ways, you get the feedback and make yours as well. So I think it can be hard for some people, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't try.
Yeah. You know, and the rest of the comment was that he would say hi and smile at people, and instead of getting a smile in response, he gets frightened looks. You know, and it's not uncommon in urban environments. People are afraid to interact with other people. I think about it, living in New Orleans, I don't even know who my neighbors are. I have no clue. I wouldn't even recognize them. You know, and when you take mankind down to a more basic, natural sort of environment, we'd be living in small tribes or villages. We would know everybody in our own little group. We might not know the next town over, the next tribe over, but we'd know some of them. But, you know, in our own community, we would know everybody.
Right.
We would know their kids, and we'd be interacting with everybody from the elderly down to the youngest. And that's a natural lifestyle. That's a natural way our whole psyche evolved was in that sort of a group. And, you know, we don't live in that world anymore. But have we evolved past it? Do we need that social interaction, that connection with neighbors, with our community at large, you know, with a greater society?
You know, we talked before about money and the challenge and the risk and the energy of money. And you see, money buys you a bigger house and a longer driveway and a bigger gate. And in so many ways, it distances you from the real world. It separates you. You end up hiring people who do the job that you once enjoyed doing. You used to love going to the grocery store or going to get your dry cleaning or whatever. Now you hire people to do it. You hire people to take care of your yard for you. And the more money you get, the more houses you have to take care of and cars, and it does add a complexity to your life. And before you know it, you really have distanced yourself from a lot of the joy of what this world is about. You know, we talked, you know, the original question was about smiling, and I laughed afterwards because I actually have a whole chapter in my book. It's called Default to a Smile. I have an entire chapter because I really believe that, you know, the smallest things make the biggest difference. And if we really all just took one thing from life, from this call, and tomorrow we just went and we smiled a little more than we did the day before, and we just shared a little bit of joy, you know what, people feel that. And it sounds so esoteric and frou-frou, but the truth is that it does make a difference. You can actually share and express energy through a smile, through sharing of joy. It really does make a difference. I mean, we've all been to big cities, like most of us anyway, Boston, New York City, and you walk down, you know, like Times Square, and everyone's in such a hurry, you'll be hard-pressed to find anybody smiling because everybody has a mission. They're all in a hurry. They all have a path and a place to go. I think we default to a frown because it's easier and it takes effort to smile.
Yeah, you know, they tell us it takes more muscles to frown than to smile, but I think back, you know, I used to live in this moderately small town, and it had 10, 12,000 people in it. And I'd watch people as I was at work. The window looked out on one of the main through streets in town. And I'd watch people driving down the street, and I'd think, my God, everybody in town must have a hobby of sucking on lemons. Every one of them has got such a sour expression. And you couldn't help but wonder, why do they all look so sour? And, you know, it's true, you start looking around anywhere. Everybody does kind of have this, I just bit into a lemon look.
You're hitting on a really big subject, I think, and I bring it back to gratitude. I think there's so many of us who look at their lives and we say, gosh, poor me, you know, I lost my job, I can't pay all my bills, you know, my sister-in-law is sick, or whatever, and it could be so much worse. I mean, just the fact that you're even on this planet is something to be grateful for. And if we could just express a little bit of that, a little bit of appreciation, it really could be worse. It really could be worse, and there's just some joy there. And there's, you know, I talk about laughter because I think laughter is amazing. Somebody told me when I got sick the first time, I had just met my wife. We were just crazy in love, and I was diagnosed with cancer. And all of a sudden, our world, we had just realized that we had just got together in this lifetime, and our world was crashing down. The doctor had said, you know, you have what I believe to be one of the fastest spreading cancers. I went to the doctor about 4 p.m. on a Friday, or maybe it was 2:30 p.m. on a Friday. At 4 o'clock, I was in with the doctor, and he said to me, we're going to operate tonight at 7 o'clock p.m. And I said, you know, I'm really sorry, but I'm not coming in. You know, I want to look at alternatives. You know, as I shared earlier, I grew up on organics and alternative medicine. Like, that just, surgery just was not in my psyche. That was not something that I was willing to do. And he said to me, look, Seth, I have dinner plans tonight, and I'm canceling them, and I'm going to be here at 7 o'clock, and you're going to be here. And I was so angry. I mean, I was just frustrated and bitter, and I left, and then I cried, and I went through all my emotions, and then my now wife and I, we cried and just kind of just held each other. And by the time 6:30 rolled around, I couldn't even walk. I was in so much pain from the cancer. And literally, I was back at the hospital. I was crying. They wheeled me in. They did the surgery. There were some odd things that happened, which I could talk about forever. But in the end, I survived, and I'm still here. But there was just this thing that happened, this understanding, this awakening for me to get through that moment. And then I think one of the nurses said, you know what, find a way to laugh, rent some funny movies, buy some funny books. And sure enough, we got Paul Reiser and Bill Cosby and you name it. We bought them all, and my wife would just read them to me, or I would read them, and we would just laugh. And it got us through just one of the hardest times we ever faced. And so smiling, yeah, that's one step closer to laughing, but laughing is so healing, and I think people have written books about it, and scientists have proven it, but boy, laughter, that, boy, that gets you through so much in life, I believe.
Yeah, I've often said that humor, including laughter, is the grease that gets us over the speed bumps of life.
Yeah,
and it's
true.
It's true. It's true. You know, I can remember laughing at my son's funeral. A lot of people may say, that's horrible. No, the guy that did the eulogy knew him very, very well and known him since he was born, had been his sensei in the martial arts when he was studying that, which was like from five on, was like an uncle to my son. And he knew him very well. He told a funny story, you know, that had involved my son. We all laughed. Because it was so much like Josh. It was just the way he was. So to laugh, even at the worst times in your life, is not unnatural. It's not wrong. You know, you shouldn't... A lot of people think that when times are tough, or you're grieving, or you're worried about something, you shouldn't smile, you shouldn't laugh, you shouldn't show any sign of humor or happiness. And... you know, that's not true. You know, that humor and that little glimmer of joy can get you over some awfully big speed bumps.
I would believe so. And it's a release of energy and so much. But yeah, it definitely got me through my situation, and I think it's helped a lot of people just to get through theirs. There's nothing amazing about facing your life with a stoic atmosphere and refusing to express emotion. There's no award you get for, you know, holding in and containing your joy in life. You don't get anything from that. But there is something to be gained by expressing your joy and expressing your happiness and even laughing once in a while. There's a lot to be gained. There's a lot to share from it. But yeah, I mean, for me, it was very healing, and I think for a lot of people it can be as well.
Oh, definitely. I totally agree on that. Yeah, without laughter, you know, and they have what is called laughing yoga or something like that. I've often thought that sounds very entertaining, you know, as far as something to get involved with, that laughing yoga sounds like something that's just designed to make you a happy person.
That's right. Yeah, I haven't tried it either. I do yoga, though, at least once or twice a week, and I will have to give that a try now that you brought that up. I'm going to have to seek that out for sure.
Yeah, well, it's available in all sorts of areas. I know there's classes in New Orleans. There's classes on the West Coast. And I'm sure Colorado sports them as well.
I'm sure we have that. I probably just never paid attention to it, but I'll have to look for it now that you brought it up.
Yeah. One of these days I'll have to get one of the instructors for laughing yoga to come on and tell us all what it's all about, because... you know, you read the ad or, you know, some little article, you see someplace and you think, well, that's interesting, but it's one of those things that you never get around to doing or trying because, you know, the trivia of life, the nuts and bolts without any matching pairs seem to get in the way. Because that's true. Many, many things that I would like to try, I just haven't had the time to do yet. Many things I'd like to learn how to do, I haven't taken the time to learn yet. And many things that I have learned to do and I really enjoyed, once I learned them and became reasonably proficient in them, I have quit doing them, even though they were things I enjoyed. I guess I've just moved on in some way, you know. I don't know why, but... And that's true for a lot of adults, though. The things that we like... we seem to, the hobbies, you know, maybe it's of art or maybe a form or maybe it's some sort of handwork that you do or whatever. You learn how to do it, you enjoy it, but then you quit doing it until, like, you're retiring. And all of a sudden you have time on your hands. It's like that I'm bored thing, you know. I listen to people who say, well, I'm bored. I have such a boring life. And I'm like... when do you have time to be bored? I always have something going on, or I'm thinking about something, or I should be thinking about something, or I should be doing something, but being bored isn't something that I've actually experienced since I was about 10 years old.
I think it's so funny how our priorities change as we move through life, and we evolve and we change. I mean, I went to college, I got scholarships in music performance that paid for a good part of my college, and then I got a scholarship in engineering, which paid for the rest of my college. And then I gave up both of those to go study business and marketing in Australia. And, you know, that was just something that I had to transition for me. But it seems like that we try things, we see what works, some things are supportive and helpful at certain times in our lives, and then we just prioritize. And for most of us, it's our family, it's our children, it's our work, and we just have to choose in our life how we're going to allocate our time. I think sometimes we do it unconsciously, and we end up spending too much time at work, and then we end up fixing the house, and we end up neglecting the things that actually were number one and number two and number three on our priority list. But I think when we can figure out what those are and plan our day around our priorities, I think it makes us happier, whether it's a hobby like knitting or even, you know, taking a little time out for ourselves somewhere in the chaos. I think we need to make a priority for ourselves to do those things. I think it just makes us happier, makes us more productive, and it clearly helps us make better decisions for our life and for our path.
Well, I think about it. Something I used to, using a scroll saw, I would cut figures out of wood, and then I would paint them, and that was something that I enjoyed doing. And, you know, I'd made a gazillion Christmas ornaments over the years. For me, the process of transferring the pattern onto the section of wood and then cutting it out on the scroll saw, it was actually a form of meditation. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about meditating while you're doing something, when you're doing something like that, it's like sewing or anything else, there's a part of your mind that's focused on it, because obviously power tools can be dangerous. You can sew through your finger, you can cut your finger off with a scroll saw, etc. So you have to be paying some attention to what you're doing. But the conscious part, the part of you that's thinking about bills and work and, you know, your relationships and, you know, all that kind of stuff, all that stuff that floats around inside of our heads, tunes out because you're focused lightly on what you're doing. But it doesn't require all your brain. So for the first time while you're busy doing this, another part of your brain is actually able to go inside, you might say. And you know, it's very meditative for me, you know, to do something like that.
Yeah, I find that when I'm doing dishes or folding laundry that it's pretty meditative for me. But if you can believe it, writing this book was probably one of the most meditative things that I ever did. When I actually sat down to write the manual for a living, it would be something where late at night, because I was working two jobs, I mean, I was already pretty busy, I had two kids, I mean, I think when I started I only had one, but, you know, it was definitely something that, you know, these weren't big pockets of time. This was, you know, 20-minute coffee break, an hour off for lunch, you know, midnight to 2 in the morning. You know, whenever I could find time, I was just striving to write, and I literally would just sit down, and I would just write. And I think maybe a lot of writers have this experience, but for me, a lot of people that have gotten the book said, well, is this channeled? Did you channel this book? And I have a belief that everything's channeled. I mean, it has to be. We're not alone here. I mean, we're part of a greater universe. And so this wisdom in many ways was came out of me in any magnitude of understanding. And it just poured out like you would pour a jug of water. It just kind of poured out of me, and I just wrote. And it was very meditative, very peaceful, very warming for my soul. It was very supportive for me. But it was definitely something where when I was finished, I was never tired. I was never exhausted. In fact, when I was done, I felt refreshed. And I think that there's things in our life that we do, like you said, that definitely are meditative but bring us peace. But it could be any number of things, mowing the lawn, knitting, even helping somebody out. There's a lot of things that we do in life that I think are refreshing and allow us to find peace in our being. Because like you said, you just get to throw away all the distractions. You focus on one or two things. And by doing that, you release so much of this anxiety that surrounds the decisions that we make.
Yeah. I have a comment from the Virtual Auditorium. It says that they like what you said, and the quote is, "We are not poor due to our lack of possessions, but due to our lack of appreciation and fulfillment in any particular moment." And possibly, in other words, we don't choose to take the time to be unhappy. Is that true? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think we're rich in money, but not in happiness. And I think we talked about that earlier with respect to our culture, is that, you know, in many ways, we're a very bitter, litigious society. We like to blame everyone else for our problems. We don't take responsibility for our choices. And our opportunity for happiness comes from taking responsibility for our choices and realizing that we actually do have control over this moment, not over the things that we don't need to control, like the weather or even like the people that we care about, but over ourselves and how we react to it. That is the true delimiter of our happiness. And I think many of us, we live the same pattern that we did yesterday. We live these lives of mediocrity because that's just how we've created our lives to be. We're not making grandiose choices. Maybe we did when we were in our teens and our 20s, but at some point we stopped and we just decided that this 9-to-5 job was what we were supposed to do, and we have to pay our bills and put money aside for college and put money in our mutual fund or whatever it is, and we just stopped really living. And I think there's something that happens inside of us where we just turn off that creative, that exciting part that kids have. You know, kids get up, gosh, my younger son is 7. He gets up like a spark plug. I mean, like you flip the switch and he is ready to rock. And I think a lot of kids are like this. He's ready. He'd like to have a marching band outside his room and a circus. And at, you know, 7 o'clock or 6:30, when he opens his eyes, you know, he is ready to sprint out the door. Me, boy, I was like that when I was a kid. But now, I mean, it takes a bulldozer to get me out of bed. I mean, I'm so immersed in my dream. It's just impossible for me to awaken myself. But, yeah, I do think that we're poor in our sharing and our experiencing of happiness. And it's just by what we talked about before, by what that great member of the audience asked about smiling. Yeah, we just don't smile enough. We just don't share our joy enough. I think that's a big problem in our community for sure.
And see, I'm one of those weird people. I wake up in the morning usually with a smile, and I'm instantly awake. When my feet hit the floor, I'm awake. Now, I may not want to talk for the first 10, 15 minutes, but I'm up and I'm motivated, and I'm in my own world that first few minutes, you might say. I might be mulling over the dream I woke up from. I might be mulling over, you know, whatever. So I'm fairly quiet, usually. I have been known to wake up and crack jokes, you know, on the second breath, but usually I'm fairly quiet. On the other hand, you know, Gregory does not like mornings. You know, that's probably one of our biggest conflicts. You know, he's a grump the first half hour. And, you know, I've learned over time, just let him be. Eventually, he will become himself again. It just takes him a little longer. To try and push the issue, for me, just it put me in that same mood, and I don't shake it in the 30 minutes. I just would end up in a bad mood. You know, all tense and starting the day that way. I was like, I don't like this. Well, I could choose my reaction to the way he wakes up in the morning. I couldn't change how he wakes up, but I can change my reaction. So, you know.
Well, it's great that you respect that about him. And it is his birthday, so I guess he had the freedom to wake up in any special way he wanted today. But I'm more like him, I have to admit. I'm definitely a slow waker-upper. I think I get immersed in my dream. I live this other life, and a lot of people do, I know. And then by the time I actually awaken, I have to reorient myself, figure out where I am. I don't want to talk to anybody right away. But I sit there, and then I go through my gratitude for the day. I go through all the things that I'm grateful for. Same thing I do when I go to bed at night, and it sets the stage for my day. And it doesn't mean that you're not going to have hard times in your day, but it sure makes a difference when you start and end your day that way. It definitely helps me put everything in perspective. And, you know, like I said earlier, none of us know how much time we have left. People die every minute, every second, and we are still here. So we have an opportunity to be of service, to follow our path in this moment until we don't have any more moments left. And there's a lot to be grateful for that.
And that's a great note to end the program on, too, because we have run out of time again. So I would like to thank everyone for joining us tonight. And Seth, you are a great guest.
Thank you, Gia. It's been an absolute pleasure for sure.
Well, I've enjoyed the program with you very much. And I hope all of the audience has as well. And that you found that it provided you plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week for another episode of The Dawn of Shade. Sure to be a fascinating conversation with our guest, Nihal Ledwith. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott. and good night.
Superman, hey little sister, who's the one you want?